I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Today, we're going to begin with a story from the state of Minnesota. But before we get there, I want to take you back to the 19th century. In 1819, President James Monroe and the U.S. Congress passed the Indian Civilization Act. It established resources and support for Christian missionaries to, quote, improve the habits and conditions of Indians. The act paved the way for indigenous children to be forcibly kidnapped from their families, held against their will in government-sponsored schools, and emotionally and physically brutalized in an attempt to rid these children of their knowledge of their language, culture, and communities. The last of the boarding schools initiated by this act closed only in 1978. This is not distant history. It's hardly even the past. I was 5 years old at the time. A lot of you were alive too when this was happening. Last year, I spoke with journalist Rebecca Nagel about her podcast, This Land, and she told me more about that extensive history of the U.S. government forcibly separating the families of Native people.
So in the late 1800s, the United States started rounding up Native children and forcing them to go to boarding schools, which were really assimilation camps. And the explicit goal of those schools was to separate Native children from their tribes and from their culture so that eventually there would no longer be Native people. The same goal was part of the Indian Adoption Project, the idea being just that Native children were simply better off in white homes. And I would argue that it's still happening today.
That it's still happening today is one conclusion readers might draw from Jessica Washington's reporting with the Fuller Project. Jessica spent 8 months speaking with Native families, lawyers, and other experts to understand why Minnesota has a disproportionately high rate of Indigenous children in the child welfare system. The foster care system, it's supposed to provide temporary housing and assistance to children whose families may be in a time of crisis. And while it's a system that's often overburdened and under-resourced, something more troubling seems to be happening in Minnesota, where Indigenous children are overrepresented in the foster system at a rate of 15 times their presence in the population. Jessica Washington spent months talking with tribal members in Minnesota, and I sat down to talk with Jessica about what she learned.
So just to give some data, less than 2% of children in Minnesota identify as American Indian, and yet 26% of children in the foster care system are American Indian. And so you're seeing really, really large disparities in the system.
Jessica, I want to stop right there and just pause on that for a moment so that people can absorb that number. You're saying fewer than 2% in the general population, but basically 1 in 4 children in foster care is Indigenous?
Yes. And when you break it down to the county level, it can be, you know, even more extreme. I looked at Beltrami County, which is a pretty small county, and about 20% of the population there identifies American Indian. And yet 88% of kids in foster care in the out-of-home placement system there are American Indian.
That's stunning. I can't just off the top of my head think of another thing that we would presume would be more sort of evenly distributed that is more outsized kind of disparity. So go ahead and continue more on what you learned in talking with families and community about these numbers.
The big thing that in talking to these women that, you know, came across very strongly was just the sense of living in fear. I spoke to one mother who, you know, she has a stable job. She has suffered from issues with addiction previously, but has been clean for years and sober. And yet she still has this kind of nightmare of thinking about child protective service workers knocking on her door every time she needs to get help for her daughter, every time she, you know, wants to get her mental health access. She worries, well, are they going to come for me this time? And so I think there's a lot of fear in this system, you know, that these mothers spoke to me about. And I also spoke to someone at the Indian Child Welfare Law Center, which is a center that works to reunite Native families. And one thing the executive director told me is that she's even had a girl who was 18 years old and just had a child who was so concerned that she might be involved in the system just because of the huge numbers she sees in her community, of children being taken away, that she was so proactive and going to them for assistance to figure out how to prevent that from happening to her, even though there wasn't even a case against her.
Tell us a bit about the history of removing Native children from their families.
Sure. So in about the mid-1800s in the United States started instituting a policy of boarding schools. So these were schools that where Native children were oftentimes forcibly or coerced into going to these schools, where their culture was taken from them, their language was taken from them. And the intent was to kind of strip the tribes of the children in their community and take away those kind of cultural and heritage ties. So generations of children ended up in these schools. There was also rampant abuse. Children were starved and they were beaten. And this happened throughout the United States. And it has a particular history in Minnesota. The last boarding school didn't close until 1978 in the United States. So we're talking about generations of families living under this fear. One of the mothers I spoke to in the story, her own mother was in the boarding school system. And she could really directly tie that kind of system of fear of family separation to her own childhood and what happened to her. She inevitably ended up in the foster care system as a child, and her own children ended up in the foster care system for a time. So there's definitely a generational tie that the mother spoke to me about, and that many of the people I spoke to in the Native community in Minnesota really saw very clearly.
So if I'm thinking like a social scientist and I see a disparity of this size, and this again is an enormous one, I feel like I could have two alternate hypotheses, right? One might say the factors that get children removed from dangerous family situations simply are more prevalent in indigenous communities. And maybe there's a lot of reasons for that, but what we see here is, for example, greater substance abuse or neglect or whatever the issues are, and perhaps they're just as hard as it might be, there's so much more of it going on here that that's why we see the disparity. The other hypothesis might say, well, the rates are similar or maybe slightly elevated, but that part of what's happening here is that decision makers, when they see, for example, substance abuse in a middle-income white household, they still think those are good parents who simply need help. But when they see substance abuse in an indigenous family, they think we got to go get those kids and separate that family. So Jessica, which one is it? Or to what extent are both of these contributing sort of more of the problems versus problematic decision making?
One thing that came up in my reporting time and time again was kind of what were the actual reasons children were ending up in the system. And when I spoke to the executive director of the ICWA Law Center, the Indian Child Welfare Act Law Center, she told me that the number one reason parents came through her door was because of poverty. And this came up time and time again with the mothers I was speaking to. You know, being unhoused was a reason to remove children. And I think poverty is really kind of at the root of this. Native Americans in the United States and in Minnesota in particular are much more likely to experience poverty. And so what I heard from the mothers I spoke to and from the experts who've been working on this issue for years is that, you know, these kind of root causes, poverty and you know, some of these other issues like trauma are being addressed through removals instead of being addressed through helping with resources. And so that was something that came up time and time again. You know, something else that came up in speaking to the women I interviewed for the story was really a focus on the cultural mismatch in terms of who is in charge making these decisions and who's being impacted. So statistically, 0% of social workers in Minnesota as of 2020 identified as Native American. And yet, as I said earlier, 26% of children in the foster care system are American Indian. So there's a real mismatch. Also, 92% of social workers in the state identify as white. And I spoke to one expert on the foster care system and on Native American issues. And one thing that she mentioned was that it's really hard to have social workers who maybe all come from a certain class background and are majority white, judging the cultural practices of Native parents and also judging the practices of parents living in poverty. And that was something she really emphasized to me, you know, this kind of mismatch of how can you understand what we're going through if you've never experienced it. So I think that's definitely something that came up in this reporting.
Is there reason to believe that poverty alone constitutes an unsafe environment for children?
Yeah. So in speaking to the mothers, a lot of them did experience poverty. They did need help. That was definitely something that they all mentioned to me, that they needed resources to better assist their children, to make sure their children were safe and fed and clothed. But they didn't feel that this constituted harm to their children. They felt like they wanted someone to reach out, the state or someone else to help them with those resources. But at no point did they explain to me that this was a danger to their children just because they were experiencing poverty or just because they were experiencing, maybe other downstream impacts of poverty.
I'm wondering if you have sort of down where the goats can get them examples here. Like, is this about seeing that, for example, two children are sharing a bed, right? I know that sometimes child welfare systems will be very anxious about the idea either that multiple children share a single sleeping surface or that maybe kids are sleeping on a air mattress rather than in a full bed. I'm just kind of wondering what some of those anxieties are in practice.
That came up actually multiple times in my reporting, this idea of family members living in close quarters. So that might be multiple generations under one household, or as you mentioned, children sharing a bed or sharing a room. And what I heard from those who'd been involved in the child welfare system for years was that definitely was used as reasons to remove children and remove Native children. And part of that is related to poverty. And part of that can also be cultural ignorance. And that's something that they mentioned multiple times that, in a lot of Native communities, and obviously there are so many tribes in the United States with all types of different practices, but in Minnesota and a lot of Native communities, there's a sense of extended family that is much closer than maybe a lot of social service workers think of as the kind of family unit. And so those families may live in multi-generational homes, and that can be really, really normal and often a part of a very safe cultural family practice. Culture also came up when I was speaking to an attorney at the Indian Child Welfare Law Center, who mentioned that one of her clients, as a part of her cultural practice, was speaking with her dead mother. And that was a part of her cultural practice, similar to praying. And a social service worker assumed that she was having a mental breakdown and used that as against her in her child welfare case. And just kind of how those things can be misinterpreted if you're not familiar with other cultures. That was definitely something that came up.
My name is Teresa Nord. My spirit name is Beneji Wong, Nibi Akwe Indigenaclaz. I am a descendant of the Navajo and Hopi Nation, and I am a proud mom of two little girls.
Teresa Nord is one of the women who spoke with Jessica Washington of the Fuller Project about the Minnesota child welfare system. As an Indigenous mother in the state, she has clear ideas of how she would like to see the system change.
Prevention services. If I had been provided, services through the school on how to get into treatment, caring for my child while in those programming, things like that, it could have made a big difference for me. Unfortunately, in the state of Minnesota, where it's deemed the treatment state, there are very, very, very little services for moms who have their children in their care. And there's not enough housing. So then you see kids going into foster care because their parents are homeless. So there's so many layers to the child welfare system that need to be changed. I feel like there's conversations that are being had, but not much action is being done. A just system to me would be prevention and family preservation.
Now let's get back to my interview with Jessica Washington. I noted that the foster care system can be necessary and useful for some families and some children during certain parts of their lives. But I asked Jessica, what should the system be doing ideally, and why some of this family separation is not meeting those goals?
In my reporting, I did come across many people who were focused on reform and who tried to really make the system better. For example, I spoke to Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Ann McCaig, and she was the first Native woman to sit on a state Supreme Court. She was also involved in Minneapolis's in Hennepin County, which is where Minneapolis is, in their child welfare system, and put in place several reforms. For example, they put in place a special ICWA court and social worker units to try and make the system better. Now, unfortunately, a lot of these reforms didn't move the needle in terms of disparities, which is something that she would readily admit. But I do think that there are some reforms that I came across in my reporting, at least looking at the data, that have had some initial success. And those reforms have really been kind of focused on resources, providing resources to families who are struggling. So an example of that is the American Indian Families Grant Program. And this is a pilot program and that gives grants to tribes and then distributes those grants down to families who've had involvement or potential involvement in child protective services. And the initial data from that does show that giving these grants to these families, helping them with resources, has prevented many of them from having their children removed. We still don't have a lot of data yet to kind of really show if that'll bear out on a larger population level, but the initial data does show some success.
And is success defined as family reunification? Is it defined as, a change in like educational accomplishment for the young people themselves? I'm wondering sort of how we even think about what constitutes success.
That's a great question. From the women I spoke to, success for them was very focused on the happiness of their children and also keeping the family unit together. And obviously, I think some of these women would argue that there are cases in which children need to be removed. That's definitely not something that they would argue with, but they do see success really as making sure that the children are healthy and happy and able to stay with their parents and with their mothers to the extent possible.
Is this a Minnesota-only problem?
It's definitely not a Minnesota-only problem. Native children are overrepresented in the foster care at roughly 2.6 times their percentage in the overall population. That's a lot lower than in Minnesota. The disparities are obviously nationwide not as bad, but there are certainly other states, certainly states with higher populations of Native children like South Dakota, Montana, that have some of these similar issues. Although I will say Minnesota does remain somewhat of an outlier in terms of just the extremeness of the disparities here.
Jessica Washington is a reporter at the Fuller Project. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And no matter what time you're listening to me, you can be sure that I have been up for hours. Because I have chickens.
Good morning, ladies.
Oh, nobody's up? Too dark. Okay, here we go.
Come on.
When my family and I moved to North Carolina in 2014, I caught the bug for backyard farming. Chickens, ducks, and yes, I've been eyeing bees and geese as well.
Bees?
Don't tell James. Perhaps it's because agriculture is the leading industry in North Carolina. I'm sure it's because growing a little of my family's food and sourcing our own eggs is a small step toward sustainability. And it turns out that having and sharing fresh eggs is also a great way to build community with your neighbors. So, of course, I was excited to learn about a new social justice and sustainability initiative right here in North Carolina. Growing Change uses sustainable practices to produce vegetables and raise livestock. And the land where they do it is a closed and abandoned prison site in Scotland County. Now, rather than being a place where the community is locked away, Growing Change has transformed the land into a place to grow food and develop young leaders. I spoke with Noren Sanford.
I'm executive director and founder of Growing Change.
And with Jaheim McCray.
I'm the third class youth leader of Growing Change.
So Growing Change began as a pilot program working with young people in Scotland, Robeson County, Hope County region of North Carolina. So we're rural section of North Carolina on the North-South Carolina border. And so we began working with young men who were kicked out of home kicked out of school and put on probation at age 14 or below, starting in 2011. And we combined a program using community gardening as a service learning component combined with a cognitive behavioral approach. And we worked with those young folks for 5 years, tracking the program and in an effort to keep folks out of our adult prison system. And so that's how we began back in 2011 with the intention of moving on to a closed prison here in Scotland County in an effort to not only see how we could reuse this old work camp prison, but also advance a national solution of what to do with the 300 closed prisons in the U.S.
Jane, do you think of yourself as a farmer or a gardener?
It's funny that you asked that. When I first joined the Growing Change, I had no idea about anything related to agriculture, hydroponics, aquaponics, keeping up with cattle. Like, I had no idea about any of it. So to answer your question in short, no, I do not consider myself a farmer. However, I do enjoy learning about new things and taking on different challenges. So I definitely will say this is a challenge that I took on that I grew very fond of.
Well, I mean, those words, agriculture and hydroponics, rolled right off your tongue like, oh, maybe I didn't used to be an expert in them, but I suspect you know a lot more now. Can you tell me a little bit about your history with Growing Change? How'd you get engaged and involved with it?
Actually, it's a pretty funny story. So as Noren said, when Growing Change first started, it was a program that kind of helped youth who were troubled to kind of find, you know, a positive place to kind of take those negativities and flip them into something positive. So the way that I got involved back in 2016, I was actually a victim to gun violence. So that was kind of my, I guess, troubled factor that led me to getting into Growing Change. And the very first thing that I did with Growing Change was I was a zombie actor in a haunted prison tour. So that was pretty amazing to partake in.
Okay, I have so many questions. Nora, maybe I'm going to come to you on this. A zombie actor in a haunted prison tour? What are y'all doing over there, Growing Change?
Yeah, so here's the short answer. So our grand opening, we worked with the county sheriff, EMS, and county leadership, and we opened up a haunted prison tour on the site. And we had about 2,500 folks come through that we were able to educate about the closed prisons and the history of work camp prisons in North Carolina.
Noren, you seem to have a real capacity for, we're going to call it outside the box, even as much as I no longer like that phrase, but certainly some outside the box thinking. So tell me about the box that is old prison sites and how you're thinking about those. And then, Jaheim, I am coming back around to you.
We probably don't think about this in the U.S. very often, the idea of closed prisons. But as I said, there are literally 300 closed prisons. If you look at Jared Williams' work out of the University of Michigan, closed prisons, decommissioned prisons, nobody on them, properties that are just wasting at this point. And in North Carolina, it is easy for us not to think about this history. But if you've driven anywhere today in our state of North Carolina, you've been part of this history. Because North Carolina used more forced prison labor than any other state in the nation to build its road system. And so by the 70s, we had more prisons than any other state, and we locked up more of our population per ratio than any other state in the nation. And so that's a history that really hasn't been talked about or unpacked in North Carolina. And so we decided that we need to answer the new question of what to do with old prisons. And the only way to do that respectfully is to build a leadership team of people who are directly impacted. So we began working with young people who were deep in the system. And then by Jaheim's class, after our clinical pilot five-year program was over, the youth had to come in from one point of struggle. And so they are the leadership team that helps us make the decisions of what properly to do with this site and how to lift it up as a national example.
So Jaheim, it sounds here like you're actually part of a group that is making decisions. How have you all been thinking about the kinds of decisions to make about these former sites?
We get our ideas from things that happen in our community, in our surrounding counties. So a lot of the things that we do, we make sure we try to keep in mind, you know, the youth that are around us that will be, I guess, locally impacted on the different things that we do. And for example, we are actually working to start our first college chapter. I'm currently a freshman here at North Carolina Agricultural Technical State University.
So yes, Aggie Pride. Okay.
Yes, ma'am. So we are actually working to get a college chapter of Growing Change started here at the university. And this would be just one of the first of many chapters on universities that we plan to open. So yeah, that's just something that I'm able to, you know, kind of start helping to construct personally here on campus. So just different things like that, trying to, you know, get Growing Change spread across the nation through this global pandemic that we're having challenges, you know, getting our name across through.
So Nora, let me ask a real basic question. Sure. When you say, you know, a former prison site, and then you say we're going to grow some food, I guess I want to know, did you test the soil? I'm a little worried about the tomato that comes from a space that may have been, you know, built on land that after all was likely, you know, land that may have had toxic chemicals or there may have been lead paint. I'm just wondering how you all think about the realities of environmental injustice in prisons and how that then translates to environmental, the attempt to go sustainable on the other side with what you're doing now.
Absolutely. That's a great question. And as we work to put together kind of the modules that we will be giving away, the Prison Flip Toolkit, actually working with North Carolina A&T State University. Our first chapter is about assessment and remediation. And so before we had any boots on the ground at the farm, we wrote and secured EPA grants to do a full assessment of the site. And so there are sections of that site that we will never be growing food in, because of the concerns that you've raised, that we've been able to identify through the EPA evaluation. Now, those sites can become nature trails. They can become adventure courses, like, but they cannot be used for food. And so one of the first opportunities is to understand the remediation plan as we turn these brown fields into green fields. What we mean by that is out of an act of environmental justice, we're reclaiming these spaces to be able to turn them into environmental assets for the community.
Norm, my last question for you is, for you, what constitutes success? How do you measure it? Maybe one way to ask is, in 10 years, Norm, how will you know if you have succeeded in this effort?
I'd say there's kind of three phases. It was before, so that five-year longitudinal program, we were 92% effective in preventing young people from ending up in a terminal incarceration or death by homicide. So that was then. Now, it is how do we properly empower, you know, our youth leaders and our community? We receive support not only from North Carolina A&T, but also from North Carolina State and MIT's design program as well. So how do we properly deploy? And then in the future, we're resisting the idea of scaling, but instead we want this to be a replicable model. And what we mean by that is putting together that prison flip toolkit. We're going to send it out through our national cooperative extension program. And so we're working with cooperative extension faculty like Dr. Michelle Ely at North Carolina A&T State University in order to make that that toolkit that will be then be made available to every county and parish through the extension program in the country.
Jaheim, I do want to end with you. I asked Noren how he will know in 5 years if the program is a success. But I want to ask this, Jaheim, for you. Clearly, you had this experience, which I'm so sorry about, of trauma around gun violence. But I hear your enthusiasm, your excitement, your intellect, your capacity. And so I'm wondering for you in 5 years, Jaheim, what's going to feel like success in your life?
To answer that question, in 5 years, I would just have been a graduate of North Carolina A&T. So honestly, just as I said earlier, you know, we're working to start a college chapter of Growing Change here on campus. So to me, that dare would be a very successful moment for me, being able to, you know, be a part of the foundation of that chapter and being able to see, you know, how well the chapter here on campus will be able to grow, as well as seeing different chapters at other universities. We also have a third class youth leader who attends North Carolina State University. So maybe we could even, you know, possibly start a chapter there. And North Carolina State is also one of the partnering universities that we work with. So being able to, you know, I guess, start chapters with universities and other partners who helped us from the beginning and allow them to continue to work alongside all of the great things that Growing Change plan on doing in the future.
Jaheim Lecrae and Noren Sanford, the only homework I have for the two of you is make sure when the weather warms up a little bit, give me a call. I'm going to drive down from Winston-Salem. I have got to see this place.
You will be welcome at any time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you. Take care.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Today is Wednesday, January 26, and a new law is set to take effect in New York State. New York's labor law, Section 740, expands today. The new rule provides further protections against employer retaliation against whistleblowing employees. Now, the new law provides more protection for more people. And to be clear, these protections became necessary during the pandemic because employees had to start reporting that their workplaces were failing to provide adequate PPE and failing to follow state rules for safe working conditions. I spoke with Rachel Green, an associate at Katz, Marshall & Banks LLP, a firm that specializes in whistleblower and employment law. We discussed the new rights that whistleblowers in New York can enjoy thanks to the expansion of labor law, Section 740.
So a whistleblower is an employee who complains about something that they reasonably believe is a violation of the law that their employer or someone else working for their employer has committed. And once they report that, if the employer retaliates against them, that employee might have a claim against the employer.
Okay. I mean, I think we see often very high profile examples of this when we're talking about like the Edward Snowdens of the world. But I presume most whistleblowing isn't happening at that level.
Absolutely. Many whistleblowers might be reporting about something like a tax violation or, especially in today's COVID-19 pandemic, lack of proper safety equipment for employees. They're usually things that are happening on the day-to-day basic level that many employees might witness and might consider, that might not be legal, but may not feel comfortable coming forward about.
So I know that you wrote a recent piece in the National Law Review highlighting New York legislation that was passed both in 2020 and 2021. What prompted this?
So many things prompted it. And you know, obviously I'm not a legislator, so I cannot speak exactly to what prompted it, but the bill sponsors did write with respect to the 2020 legislation that they were concerned about the COVID-19 pandemic, and they wanted to provide medical professionals in particular greater whistleblower protections to try to speak more freely about the conditions of themselves in the workplace, as well as their patients.
And so were these things like not getting sufficient PPE or being asked to work, you know, closer than 6 feet? What were some of those sort of COVID-related experiences?
Mostly the PPE. That's something that the legislature particularly highlighted as a concern. And also of note, employees during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, when things were really scary and we knew nothing about even how to prevent the spread of COVID, many healthcare workers were reporting concerns over social media. And before these 2020 and 2021 amendments, those types of reports over social media would not have been protected under New York law as protected activity under the whistleblower law. And so legislators were concerned because they thought, we don't even know what's going on with the COVID-19 pandemic, and our healthcare workers are quite literally paving the way. And if they're not protected from reporting something that may be of concern, the legislature took it upon themselves to make some changes to make sure that our healthcare workers are protected.
So help me a bit when you say protected. What kinds of retaliation were people experiencing?
So at the time, some employees would have been fired. They may have been demoted. They may have been asked to move to less favorable shifts. There are many different acts that employers can take to, quote, retaliate against the employees. Most people think of hiring and firing as the main activities of an employer, but there are a lot of different ways that employers can take a negative action that would be quite harmful to an employee's activities on the job.
So help us think about how this new legislation over the past couple of years out of New York sort of places New York relative to, for example, federal whistleblower laws.
Before this new legislation, New York state law was quite behind. It lagged behind federal laws and the protections that employees had under federal laws. And one good example of that is before this new legislation, an employee had to demonstrate that there was an actual violation of the law in order to be protected. But most employees are likely to be unfamiliar with the ins and outs of what actions might constitute an actual violation of the law. So this undoubtedly spooked many employees from complaining at all and doomed many retaliation claims. But now this new law imposes what's called a reasonable belief standard. So if an employee reasonably believes that the employer's action is in violation of a law, they might be protected. And that's a huge deal. That reflects both the federal standard and the standards in several other states. I looked into New Jersey, Maine, California. Many states follow this reasonable belief standard, and it's an important expansion of protection. It's also significant because this New York whistleblower law now protects both private and public employees the same. New York Civil Service Law 75B protects public employees under the same reasonable belief standard. Private employees were under a different standard. So now New York is bringing its entire public and private employee base under the same standard.
This is largely speculative, but I still just sort of want your opinion on this. Do you think that other states will follow the lead of New York on this?
So that's an interesting question. In some aspects of the law, New York is catching up to other states, most notably New Jersey, who famously has a very expansive whistleblower protection law called the Conscientious Employee Protection Act, has very broad language. So in some respects, New York is catching up to other states and to the federal protections. But it's possible. I mean, New York, California, DC, they've often been leaders in these types of protections for employees across the United States. And if other legislatures are trying to think about language to use to expand protections for employees and for whistleblowers, yes, they might look to New York's new legislation because it has very good protections for employees.
So what about folks who have never thought about, again, I think sometimes when we hear the word whistleblower, we're thinking of very high level policy, you know, top secret kinds of spy games. But it's so helpful to understand, no, we're talking about frontline workers who don't have sufficient PPE, who go on their Facebook page and say, hey, you know, my employer is not providing sufficient PPE. So what might you say to a takeaway listener who's thinking, what does whistleblowing have to do with me?
Well, I think a lot of these changes hopefully make this law a little bit more accessible and more understandable to the average employee who might not be working in those high-level policy parts of their job. And so, for example, one aspect of the law requires that employers must notify folks who work for them, as well as applicants, of their protections. And that's now part of the law. So if an employer does not post that, any employee, if you don't see that notice, that employee might be eligible to, quote, blow the whistle to say, hey, employer, you're required to post this notification and you don't. And so that's something that anybody could notice in the employee workroom or the lunchroom, break room, what have you. There should be some sort of notice. And if there isn't, that's a violation that might render that employee eligible to blow the whistle. And that's something everybody can get involved in.
Rachel Green, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Listen, talking about farming has me a little bit up in my feelings, so I think maybe I'll go out back and check on my leading lady, Harriet, my mean but beautiful little rooster, Rakim, and all their chicken buddies. And of course, we always want to hear your stories and your concerns. We want to hear what you're thinking about. So call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway, especially if you have chicken pics. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.